December 7th, 1958. Portland, Oregon. 54-year-old Kenneth Martin, his 48-year-old wife Barbara, and their three daughters, 14-year-old Barbie, 12-year-old Virginia, and 10-year-old Susan, leave their home in their station wagon to travel to the Columbia River Gorge. When they fail to return, they are reported missing the following evening. Just under 5 months later, the bodies of Susan and Virginia are discovered at separate locations in the Columbia River, and evidence suggests that the Martins' station wagon crashed into the water. However, other evidence, such as the discovery of a blood-stained gun which is traced back to the Martins' surviving son, points to the family being victims of an elaborate murder plot, but this is never proven, and no trace of Kenneth, Barbara, and Barbie are found. After that, the trail went cold. Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I am your host Robin Warder, and we've got a unique missing persons case to cover today. The 1958 disappearance of the Martin family. Or should I say, it's a story where some of the victims are missing, but others have been confirmed to be deceased. It involves a couple named Kenneth and Barbara Martin, who left on a road trip with their three daughters before the entire family and their station wagon vanished without a trace. The bodies of two of the children would eventually be found floating in the Columbia River, but the rest of the family, as well as their vehicle, have never been located. Now, I know what you're probably thinking here. The Martins obviously drove their car into the river, the missing victims are still submerged underwater, and the whole thing was nothing more than a tragic accident. Well, I'll admit that when I first came across this case on the Charlie Project website a long time ago, I thought the exact same thing. But there's been renewed interest in the case in recent years, thanks largely to the publication of a book which came out last summer, titled Echo of Distant Water, The 1958 Disappearance of Portland's Martin Family. The author, J.B. Fisher, had taken an interest in the Martin case and decided to go through the old case files, where he made some interesting discoveries to suggest there's a lot more to this story and that the family may have been victims of foul play. A pair of ex-convicts just happened to be frequenting the area where the Martins were last seen, but most intriguingly, a gun would be found which was linked to the family's surviving son, Donald, who was serving in the Navy and stationed in New York at that time. Donald apparently did not have the best relationship with his family, so there has been suspicion that he may have helped orchestrate their disappearance. A number of different theories have been formed about what ultimately happened to the Martin family, and we're going to explore all of them on today's episode. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now delve into the bizarre story of the Martin family. Our story begins in Portland, Oregon in 1958, and our central figures are the Martin family, who reside in a suburban neighborhood on Northeast 56th Avenue. The patriarch of the family is 54-year-old Kenneth Martin, who has been married for many years to his 48-year-old wife, Barbara. Kenneth works as a supervisor for the repair department of the Eccles Electric Home Service Company, and the couple have four children, including three daughters, 10-year-old Susan, 12-year-old Virginia, and 14-year-old Barbara, who goes by the nickname Barbie. In addition, the Martins also have a 28-year-old son named Donald, who is serving in the Navy and currently stationed on the other side of the country at Fort Schuyler in New York. Sometime between 1:30 and 2 p.m. on the afternoon of Sunday, December the 7th, Kenneth, Barbara, and their three daughters decided to climb into the family vehicle, a cream and red 1954 Ford Country Squire station wagon, to take a road trip. They were planning to travel east to make an excursion into the Columbia River Gorge, a canyon which stretches 80 miles through Oregon and Washington State. Their trip would likely involve picking up a Christmas tree and collecting some other fresh greens to put together wreaths and other holiday decorations. Before they left, the Martins had been invited to a friend's home for Sunday dinner, but they declined because of the trip, with Kenneth stating, quote, "We had better do as planned." But sometime over the course of the next several hours, the Martins would vanish without a trace. On Monday morning, December the 8th, Kenneth failed to show up for his job at the electric company, and all three of the Martin daughters were absent from school that day without any notice from their parents. Since it was very out of character for Kenneth to miss work, he was reported missing later that evening, and the police decided to check the Martin residence. Neither the family nor their station wagon were there, and everything appeared to be undisturbed. The dishes from their Sunday morning breakfast were in the sink, and a load of laundry was in the washing machine. Kenneth was known for playing Santa Claus for the neighborhood children, and a Santa suit he had worn to a Christmas party on the evening of December 6th was still laid out. An extensive search effort would be launched for the Martin family, and since a considerable amount of money had been left behind in their bank accounts, it seemed very unlikely they took off voluntarily. Investigators attempted to retrace the Martins' movements on the afternoon they went missing. Once their disappearance made the news, witnesses came forward who recalled seeing them on a property called Martin's Acreage, which was known for selling Christmas trees. The property was located just off the old Columbia River Highway on Larch Mountain Road, over 30 miles outside of Portland. Since this was in the Columbia River Gorge area, it would have made sense for the Martins to have visited that property, but when shown photographs of the family, neither the owner nor his wife could be 100% certain they saw them there. The next promising lead occurred 2 weeks later, when a credit card bill showed up in the Martins' mailbox, which showed that Kenneth had purchased 5 gallons of gasoline on December the 7th. The transaction took place at Dean's Chevron Service Station, located in the town of Cascade Locks, and sure enough, Kenneth's signature was on the receipt. Cascade Locks was located in Hood River County, 40 miles east of Portland, and there would be another intriguing sighting 20 miles east of there, in the town of Hood River, later that same afternoon. A waitress at a restaurant called the Paradise Snack Bar claimed that she served the Martins food there sometime between 4:30 and 5 p.m. She said it was around dusk when they climbed into a station wagon and appeared to be heading west as they drove away. There would also be multiple reported sightings of the Ford station wagon between 5:15 and 5:30 that same evening. All the eyewitnesses said they saw it parked by the highway at a cape called Trotter's Point, located 8 miles east of Cascade Locks, next to the Columbia River. Some of them reported seeing a Christmas tree in the back of the station wagon, and one witness recalled seeing a second car parked near it. One couple would also report seeing the station wagon parked on an access road, and that two young men appeared to be standing by the vehicle and talking to the people inside. Interestingly enough, the following day, motorists started noticing an abandoned white 1951 Chevrolet parked by the highway at Trotter's Point in almost the exact location the station wagon had been seen. Since it did not match the description of the Martins' vehicle, the local police paid little attention to the Chevy, and it would be 10 days before it was finally towed away from that spot. By the time 1959 arrived, there was still no sign of the Martins, but a volunteer searcher would make an interesting discovery in early January. While searching a rocky bluff near the town of The Dalles, located over 20 miles southeast of Hood River, he noticed some tire tracks which appeared to drive off the edge of the cliff into the Columbia River. It would later turn out that the tire treads seemed to match the tires on the Martins' Ford station wagon. Paint chips were also found on a nearby rock, and when sent to the FBI for analysis, a match was made to that particular station wagon's paint. By this point, searches had been conducted for the missing vehicle in the Columbia River near Cascade Locks. The location was in close proximity to Bonneville Dam, but nothing could be found, and the searches were called off when one of the divers nearly drowned. The investigation hit a standstill, but there would be some shocking developments 4 months later. On May the 1st, a dredging operation was taking place near the Dalles, which involved a drilling barge dropping large anchors into the river. On this particular day, one of the anchors wound up getting caught on a large object deep beneath the water. While the crew attempted to bring the object to the surface, one of the deckhands stuck his pole into the water and struck something which he believed was metal. But before they could actually see it, the anchor came loose, and the object wound up plunging back down over 100 feet. The crew members believed they had hooked onto a vehicle, and would later say they saw what looked like a bundle of clothes surfacing in the water in the distance before it floated downstream. Well, only 2 days later, the crew of a tugboat came across what appeared to be the body of a young girl on the north bank of a waterway called the Columbia Slough. The location was near the town of Commas, Washington, approximately 70 miles west of the Dalles. When the body was recovered, dental records would positively identify the victim as Susan Martin. On May the 4th, just 1 day after Susan was found, another body of a young girl would be discovered floating in the river roughly 25 miles east, this time in the Bonneville Dam spillway. Once again, dental records would be used for an identification, and the victim turned out to be Virginia Martin. An autopsy would find traces of food, including hamburgers and fries, in both Susan and Virginia's stomachs. Since the waitress at the Paradise Snack Bar in Hood River had recalled serving the Martin family burgers and fries on the day they went missing, this seemed to clarify that her sighting was genuine. The digestion of the food seemed to indicate that the girls had eaten 2 hours before they died, placing their approximate times of death at around 6:30 p.m. on December the 7th. Since both bodies were heavily decomposed, an exact cause of death was difficult to determine, though the medical examiner would officially declare it to be drowning. However, a deputy sheriff who fingerprinted the victims and photographed Virginia's body would later claim that he saw holes in both of the girls' skulls, though no mention of this was made in the medical examiner's report. Anyway, it turned out that the location where the drilling barge caught the large object with the anchor just happened to be located right near the rocky bluff where the tire tracks had been found months earlier. So investigators were now convinced that the Martins' station wagon had gone off the cliff into the river, and when the barge attempted to raise the vehicle to the surface, they wound up dislodging one of the doors, causing Susan and Virginia's bodies to come loose and float downstream to the locations where they were eventually found. While divers would perform a search of the area where the station wagon was believed to be submerged, poor visibility would make it difficult to see anything underwater. While some investigators believed that the Martins had driven their vehicle into the river accidentally, others suspected that it was pushed off the cliff deliberately. This included the lead investigator on the case, Detective Walter Graven of the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, who became convinced that the family were victims of foul play. There didn't seem to be any logical reason for the Martins to have driven to the Dalles, and it was also strange that they were seen eating in Hood River. According to Kenneth's friends and family, he did not like to drive in the dark, but since the Martins were leaving the restaurant at dusk, this would have required him to make a 60-mile drive back to Portland at night. Another odd detail is that a neighbor of the Martins recalled seeing a black taxi parked outside their residence on the morning of December the 8th, the day after the family went missing, and it remained there for about an hour for unknown reasons. And remember that abandoned white Chevrolet, which was seen parked at Trotter's Point for 10 days? Well, it turned out the car had originally been stolen from Venice, California, by an ex-convict named Lester Kenneth Price, as his friend had apparently let him borrow the Chevy, but Price never brought it back. During the time period the Martins went missing, Price would be seen in the presence of another ex-convict named Roy Light. The two men had served time together at San Quentin, and Light lived in the Dalles. Believe it or not, the owner of the Paradise Snack Bar, who was personally acquainted with the two men, claimed that he saw Light and Price together in the restaurant on December the 7th while the Martins were there, and the two men and the family all left at approximately the same time. According to a local informant named Clifford Slim Bennett, Light and Price spent a few days staying at a brothel he ran in Dallas-Fort Washington before they left the area after December the 10th. But this wasn't the only strange discovery. On January the 18th, a man found a .38 Colt Commander handgun underneath a rock just outside Cascade Locks, not far from the location where the Chevrolet had been abandoned. The gun had dried blood on the handle, its butt had been damaged, and a fired single shell casing was in the chamber. Even though the man turned in the gun to the Hood River County Sheriff's Office, for whatever reason, it was not processed as evidence, and the sheriff just gave him the gun back. Well, interestingly enough, one of the crew members from the drilling barge would tell Detective Graven that Roy Light had once attempted to sell him a beat-up .38 Colt Commander handgun. Even though the gun had not been kept as evidence, its serial number was still recorded, and this information would help take the case in a surprising direction. Raven wound up tracing the gun to a Meyer & Frank department store in Portland, and it turned out it had been stolen in September of 1955. But the shocking revelation was that the alleged culprit was the Martins' surviving son, Donald, who had been employed in the store at that time, but was fired after he was accused of stealing over $2,000 worth of items, including that very handgun. Since Kenneth Martin reimbursed the store for the stolen items, no charges were ever filed, but the gun was one of the items which was never recovered. Donald would soon be sent to a religious college in Connecticut before he enlisted in the Navy in an apparent attempt to set him straight. Even before he was linked to the gun, there were already suspicions about Donald, who seemed to have a strained relationship with his family. During the initial search efforts for them, he did not even bother to travel back to Oregon and only allowed himself to be interviewed by Detective Graven over the phone. Donald's first trip out west did not take place until March of 1959, and that was in order to help settle his family's estate, as he was the sole beneficiary. When the bodies of Susan and Virginia were discovered 2 months later, Donald did not attend a memorial service which was held for them, and he later claimed that he had gotten the dates mixed up. Susan and Virginia would both be cremated, and the remains were not claimed for over 10 years, though it's unclear who actually claimed them. Donald's first face-to-face interview with Graven finally took place in June, and while he expressed his belief that his family's deaths were not an accident, he said he could not think of anyone who would have had a motive to harm them. Donald claimed that the theft at the department store took place because he was experiencing great personal strain at the time, as his parents had recently found out he was having an affair with another man and did not approve of his sexuality. When asked about the missing handgun, Donald denied ever having it and said that a friend of his named Wayne took it. At the time, Wayne had also been employed at Meyer & Frank, and he and Donald were sharing a basement apartment together. By 1959, Wayne was newly married and working as a physical education teacher at Cascade Locks High School. Now, this Wayne character is a bit of an enigma. While researching the original case files for his book, J.B. Fisher found no indication that Graven ever interviewed Wayne, though he did mention his name several times in his notes. At one point, Graven wrote, quote, "Wayne, friend of Donald Martin," followed by the phrase, "put grease on a spot you don't want chickens to roost." Well, when KOIN-TV in Portland did a 50th anniversary news story about the Martins' disappearance in 2008, Wayne decided to come forward and do an interview with them. He claimed that he had been questioned by Graven and discussed the possibility of Donald being involved in the murders of his family. Wayne stated that because of Donald's underground, quote-unquote, lifestyle, he could have potentially found some professional killers to hire for the job. When asked what he meant by lifestyle, Wayne replied, quote, "the gay lifestyle." According to Wayne, Donald's parents had once caught him in the act with another man inside their home, And Wayne acknowledged that even though he went on to get married and start a family, Donald had once introduced him to the quote-unquote gay lifestyle. Indeed, when Donald was caught stealing the items from Meyer and Frank, he actually told the managers that he was having a difficult time at home because his parents had recently learned that he was gay and did not approve of it. During his research, J.B. Fisher also uncovered an old note in which Graven had written, quote, had to be planned by, before a name that was scratched out, followed by the words, no one else with motive. Computer photo enhancement would later show that the name which had been scratched out was Donald. But in spite of Graven's suspicions, the investigation would hit a standstill, as Graven was apparently told to leave the case alone and wrote in his notebook, quote, even though I can get no cooperation from anyone, there is no murder that can't be solved, end quote. He would pass away in 1988. As for Donald, he would eventually get married and start a family of his own before moving to Hawaii, where he died in 2004 at the age of 73. According to Donald's children and grandchildren, he never spoke about his family, and they did not even learn he lost his parents and three sisters until shortly before he passed away. After 6 decades, Kenneth, Barbara, and Barbie Martin are officially still missing persons, and the exact circumstances of what actually happened to the Martin family remain a mystery. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So like I mentioned in the intro, when I first learned about this case years ago, I didn't think it was anything more than a tragic accident, but I'd say that Echo of Distant Water has caused me to look at this case in an entirely different light. It's interesting to read J.B. Fisher's account about how when he first learned about the story, he couldn't find very much information online about it, aside from the profile pages of the three missing Martin family members at the Charlie Project. While the profile pages have since been updated with new details, the original write-ups were pretty basic because of the lack of available information, and it just sounded like a standard case of a vehicle driving into a river and the missing victims just never being found. Whenever someone in their vehicle goes missing at the same time, I usually suspect that they drove into a body of water, but in this particular case, I think there's a pretty good chance the real explanation is not so simple, and that something a lot more sinister happened. When you search through newspapers.com, you'll see that the Martin family disappearance got quite a bit of coverage at the time it originally happened, but it seemed to fade from the spotlight shortly after the bodies of Susan and Virginia were discovered, and was mostly forgotten about for the next several decades, though there has been a recent resurgence of interest in the case. J.B. Fisher based a lot of his research on the original case files and notes from Detective Walter Graven, and it seems apparent that Graven faced considerable resistance from other members of law enforcement. At first, I could not figure out why they would be so averse to investigating the disappearance of an entire family. Yes, I do get the impression that some of the investigators on the case developed tunnel vision and were convinced the Martins' deaths were accidental. There were also jurisdictional issues, since Graven was a detective from Multnomah County, and the Martins technically went missing in Hood River County. But there has been speculation that some of the resistance may have been the result of connections to Clifford Slim Bennett. As you might recall, Bennett became involved in the investigation when he told police that the two ex-cons, Lester Kenneth Price and Roy Light, stayed with him at a brothel he ran in Dallas-Port, Washington, during the time period the Martins went missing. Well, the brothel just happened to be located almost directly across the river from the cliff where the tire tracks had been found. In the preceding years, Bennett had been involved in his fair share of criminal activities, including running an illegal bootlegging joint in Portland, and there were allegations that he had bribed high-ranking law enforcement officials to continue his operations unimpeded. Graven would tell his family he believed that members of the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office and the Oregon State Police had money tied up in Bennett's brothel. I have my doubts that Bennett was directly involved in the Martin family's disappearance, but I think there was paranoia that conducting an extensive missing persons investigation in the Dalles might cause other unrelated criminal activities to surface, which is why certain people did not want Graven sticking his nose into their business. Now, the one fact which I think is probably indisputable is that the Martins' missing Ford station wagon is submerged in the Columbia River somewhere, and the bodies of Kenneth, Barbara, and Barbie are still inside. The theory that the drilling barge dislodged one of the vehicle's doors and caused the bodies of Susan and Virginia to come loose and float downstream makes complete sense, and I have little doubt that's what happened, especially when you consider that this took place a short distance away from the cliff where the tire tracks were found. Since this pinpoints an approximate location where the car might be underwater, you might be wondering why nothing else has ever been found, but searching for it is not as easy as it looks. Searches have been conducted, but the visibility is poor, the water is over 100 feet deep, and even a 2-ton anchor was unable to bring the vehicle to the surface without giving away. But of course, the big catch-22 here is that many people believe the investigation cannot go anywhere until the vehicle is found and there's more conclusive evidence of what happened. While the bodies of Susan and Virginia were recovered, they were heavily decomposed, and the medical examiner did not see any noticeable signs of foul play, but we have one witness who was certain he saw holes, which could have been gunshot wounds, in their skulls. Unfortunately, all that remains from the autopsy after all these years is one photograph of Virginia's body, but it's nowhere near clear enough to tell if she has a hole in her head. Since the girls' bodies were subsequently cremated, the only way to conclusively prove foul play might be to recover the bodies of the other missing family members. There was one part of the original investigation which was bungled in a completely jaw-dropping way, and that's the handling of the blood-stained .38 Colt Commander handgun. As you recall, the weapon was found near the location where the stolen Chevrolet was abandoned, which could be linked to Lester Kenneth Price. When the person who found the gun attempted to turn it in to the local sheriff's office, it seems like instead of processing it for evidence, they just said, "Well, finders keepers," and let the guy take it home. And that's not an exaggeration. In 1986, the widow of the man who found the gun actually did an interview for a news segment about the case and held up the handgun on camera to show that she still had it after all these years. Obviously, the dry blood had since been cleaned off, and the butt of the gun had been repaired, but she did confirm that it was damaged at the time it was originally found, as if it had been used to bludgeon someone. Well, obviously, after all this, there's no way that weapon will ever be admissible as evidence against someone, but it just blows my mind that it was not checked for fingerprints. Even if it had no connection to the Martin case, the presence of dry blood should be a pretty good indication that the gun was used for some sort of crime. However, at the very least, I'm glad the serial number was recorded, because this allowed Detective Graven to discover that the gun was allegedly stolen by Donald Martin from a department store he was working at 3 years earlier. If Donald was not involved in his family's disappearance, then that's a pretty astonishing coincidence, and as far as I'm concerned, this is the strongest indicator that the Martins did not just simply die in an accident. But let's start at the very beginning. The story is that the Martins left on the road trip in order to travel to the Columbia River Gorge to get a Christmas tree and some greens for decorations, which makes sense since this was something they did around the holidays pretty much every year. However, the thing which raised some eyebrows is when they turned down the invitation for Sunday dinner with friends, as I get the impression that they got together for this on an almost weekly basis. Kenneth apparently responded with the words, quote, "We had better do as planned," which can be interpreted in any number of ways. This becomes even more unusual when you consider that the Martins were seen by a waitress at the Paradise Snack Bar in Hood River later that day. I know there was initially some skepticism about the waitress's sighting, as some people believed she could have served an entirely different family and mistaken them with the Martins, but the fact that burgers and fries were found among Susan and Virginia's stomach contents after their bodies were recovered seems to corroborate her story. Even if they did not visit the Paradise Snack Bar, Those girls ate somewhere only about 2 hours before their deaths. So perhaps the Martins turned down Sunday dinner because they wanted to take the girls out for burgers and fries that night, but why would they travel 60 miles to do so? Earlier that afternoon, the Martins were allegedly seen purchasing a Christmas tree at a property on Larch Mountain Road, although the owner could not be 100% certain they were there. But remember, some of the witnesses who reported seeing the Martins' station wagon at Trotter's Point thought they saw a Christmas tree in the back of the vehicle. And of course, we also have the credit card receipt showing that Kenneth purchased fuel at a gas station in Cascade Locks, which is on the route from Larch Mountain Road to Hood River. Since purchasing a tree seemed to be the main purpose of the Martins' trip that day, what compelled them to travel there instead of returning to Portland? It was also around dusk when they were seen leaving the Paradise Snack Bar, which many people found unusual, since Kenneth hated driving in the dark, and it would take him over an hour to get home from there. Of course, if Kenneth was not adept at driving at nighttime, then this could provide a potential explanation for him accidentally driving into the river, but the problem is that the waitress said the Martins were heading west when they left, but the tire tracks found next to the cliff in the Dalles were over 20 miles east in the opposite direction. If those tracks belonged to the station wagon, then it's harder to believe that the Martins drove into the river by accident, since there's no logical reason for them to have been there in the first place. So as you can imagine, there has been much speculation that the Martins had ulterior motives for taking this trip to Hood River County. Well, one theory which was pushed around and is addressed in Echoes of Distant Water is the possibility that the Martins' oldest daughter, Barbie, had become pregnant, and the family took the trip to Hood River County so that Kenneth could confront the child's biological father. While there is no real evidence to support this theory, Barbie did make an unexplained trip to see a doctor in Vancouver, Washington, a few months before her disappearance, even though the family had a regular doctor in Portland, which might suggest something secretive on her part. While no documentation could be found in which Detective Graven specifically wrote about this pregnancy theory, there was an entry in his notebook dated June 2, 1959, in which he wrote, quote, "With Donald Martin eliminated, had to be a friend whom Ken Martin had found out about and was going to expose. Therefore, had to be a married man or one going to be married," end quote. So does this imply that Graven had changed his mind on his initial suspicions about Donald and now had a different theory? That's not quite clear, but I don't think Graven ever wavered from the idea that Kenneth took this lengthy trip because he was planning to meet someone, but this person ultimately murdered the entire family. However, the biggest issue I've had with the idea that Kenneth had a secret meetup about a serious topic is that I don't understand why he would bring all three of his daughters along. If it involves something sensitive, like Barbie becoming pregnant, you'd think he would want to shield Susan and Virginia from the situation. I guess it's possible that their annual trip to pick up a Christmas tree was just a cover story, and Kenneth took his kids out for burgers and fries at the Paradise Snack Bar in order to keep them happy and justify the lengthy trip to Hood River County. But I don't know, it just seems more practical for the Martins to leave their daughters at home and get someone else to watch over them rather than involve them in something like this. And of course, we can't overlook the multiple eyewitness sightings of the station wagon parked by the highway near Trotter's Point, which is nearly halfway between Hood River and Cascade Locks. Some of these witnesses recalled seeing either two men standing outside the station wagon or a second car parked nearby, so perhaps after leaving the restaurant, the Martins traveled west for a secret meetup there, or someone followed them and forced them to pull over. But then something happened which led to the station wagon traveling nearly 30 miles east to the Dalles and being driven off the rocky bluff into the river with the entire family inside. This theory does make sense when you consider that the two ex-cons, Lester Kenneth Price and Roy Light, were seen at the Paradise Snack Bar around the exact same time the Martins were supposedly there, and a Chevrolet which Price had stolen from California was abandoned at Trotter's Point in very close proximity to where the station wagon had been seen. And Price and Light spent December the 7th until the 10th staying in Dallesport, which is directly across the river from the cliff where the tire tracks were found. The two cons may have followed the Martins to Trotter's Point and climbed into the station wagon to force them to drive to the Dalles at gunpoint, which would explain why they abandoned the Chevy at that spot. One theory presented in Echoes of Distant Water is that one of the men managed to hide inside the station wagon before the Martins left the restaurant, and after the family climbed in and drove away, he forced them to pull over at Trotter's Point before he was joined by his partner. Honestly, if this is how events actually played out, I'd be inclined to think the crime was some sort of robbery gone wrong and that the Martins were targeted when the cons saw them at the restaurant. Otherwise, why would these two particular guys decide to murder an entire family? As far as I can tell, neither of these men were ever questioned by police about the Martins. What's interesting is that while Lester Kenneth Price's name was mentioned during the original news coverage, mostly due to the stolen Chevy being linked to him, there was no mention of Roy Light. If you search Price's name on newspapers.com, you'll find quite a few articles about various criminal activities he was involved with over the years. In fact, in 1967, Price made the news after he was arrested for counterfeiting, and he actually said that since he had literally spent half of his life behind bars by that point, he actually preferred being in prison. But there's virtually no information out there about Light, though a photograph of him could be found in Detective Graven's original case files. But during his research, J.B. Fisher uncovered a mugshot of a criminal named Richard Allen Hunt and became convinced he was Roy Light. On March 24, 1959, Hunt was pulled over outside the town of Harrisburg, Oregon, by the local police chief for having improper license plates on his car, but Hunt proceeded to pull out a gun and abduct him and drove about 9 miles before he let the chief go. This soon led to a police chase in which Hunt crashed his car outside the town of Brownsville, but he proceeded to shoot and wound their local police chief and managed to escape the scene on foot. A massive manhunt would take place, and Hunt even spent a week on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted Fugitives list before he was captured in Wyoming on June the 2nd. After doing a stint in prison, Hunt was released in 1968. Now, Echoes of Distant Water features photos of both Richard Allen Hunt and Roy Light, and I gotta tell you, the similarities are so striking that unless those guys were long-lost identical twins, I'm pretty certain they are the same person. When he was originally pulled over, Hunt was wanted on a federal warrant for interstate transportation of a stolen car, which probably explains why he decided to kidnap a police chief at gunpoint for a seemingly routine traffic violation. But this was only 3 months removed from the Martin family's disappearance, and if Hunt was involved in that, I can see why he would have gone to extreme lengths to avoid the police. However, by the time Hunt was captured, I don't think anyone had put two and two together and connected him to the Martin case, so he was probably never questioned about it. Honestly, since neither Price or Light/Hunt seemed to have any discernible connection to the Martins, I would ordinarily be inclined to think that the family was simply in the wrong place at the wrong time and were preyed upon by a group of criminals, but once again, the discovery of the .38 Colt Commander handgun, which can be linked to Donald Martin, is too much of a coincidence to ignore. And the fact that Donald claimed his friend Wayne was the person who actually stole the gun, and Wayne just happened to be living in Cascade Locks at that time, is just one coincidence too many, as far as I'm concerned. Well, we know that Detective Graven had suspicions about Donald, and I can definitely see why. Donald had a strained relationship with his family, he was the sole beneficiary of their estate, and he seemed to have very little interest in searching for them while they were missing, or mourning his two sisters once they were found dead. But of course, the issue with implicating Donald is that he was living 3,000 miles away in New York at the time. I'm not exactly sure what Donald's exact alibi was on the day his family went missing, but even back in 1958, I'm sure it would have been difficult for him to travel from New York to Oregon and back again without leaving some sort of paper trail. After all, he was enlisted in the Navy, so any absences would have been noted. The idea has been put forward that Donald could have hired Price and Light to get rid of his family, but how would he have organized this from the other side of the country as both these criminals operated on the West Coast. But it's definitely tempting to think that Donald's enigmatic friend Wayne might have been involved. Wayne's last name has never been released publicly, but J.B. Fisher claims that he found him on Facebook and that Wayne was still alive at the time Echoes of Distant Water was published. And of course, Wayne shared his own insights about the case when he came forward in 2008 to do an interview. Even after Donald moved away, Wayne claimed that he still kept in touch with the Martin family and that the last time he saw them was at a barbecue during the summer of 1958, before he moved to Cascade Locks. It's interesting how Detective Graven's old notes mention Wayne's name alongside the phrase, quote, "Put grease on a spot, you don't want chickens to roost." Graven also wrote, quote, "Had to be a friend whom Ken Martin had found out about and was going to expose. Therefore, had to be a married man or one going to be married," end quote. Well, Wayne would end up getting married in March of 1959. And as politically incorrect as this might sound today, at one point, Graven actually scrawled out the words, quote, "Wayne, homo." Well, that would definitely qualify as a secret that a newly married man wouldn't want exposed, especially in the 1950s. During his 2008 interview, Wayne definitely implied that Donald was gay. He even went so far as to say that Donald introduced him to the quote-unquote gay lifestyle, though it doesn't look like he explicitly said that he and Donald were lovers. But I'd say that's certainly a good possibility, as they were both sharing a basement apartment and working at Meyer and Frank together in 1955. As you might recall, Wayne shared a story about Donald being caught in the act with another man by his parents, but since no one seems to know who this man was, Wayne may have been referring to himself. When Donald was caught stealing items from the department store, he tried to blame it on the stress of his family finding out he was gay and not reacting well to it. I get the impression this is why his parents sent him to the other side of the country to attend a religious college, as they hoped he would eventually join a ministry, though he ultimately decided to enlist in the Navy. While Donald and Wayne both went on to get married and start families, homosexuality was still an incredibly taboo subject back then, so either or both of them might have just done this for appearance's sake. If Wayne was involved in the Martin family's murders, then perhaps the crime was motivated by Kenneth threatening to expose his big secret, which would explain why he traveled all the way to Hood River County. In fact, if you put more stock into the pregnancy theory, then it's possible this whole thing had nothing to do with Donald. Kenneth may have wanted to confront Wayne because he was the father of his 14-year-old daughter's unborn child, which also would have been pretty scandalous. To cover this up, Wayne hired Price and Light to take care of the problem, and even supplied them with the gun he stole from the department store years earlier to use as the murder weapon. One of the strangest clues in this case is the eyewitness sighting of the black taxi parked outside the Martin residence on the morning of December the 8th. This was after the Martins were last seen, but before they were officially reported missing, and the taxi was apparently there for about an hour. It seems like due to a miscommunication, this sighting was not reported to the authorities for months, by which point it was more difficult to do a follow-up investigation with the local cab companies. Well, in June of 1959, when Donald finally traveled to Portland and visited the house, he claimed that income tax papers, a bank ledger book, and other financial documents belonging to his father were no longer inside his desk and had inexplicably gone missing. If Donald was telling the truth, then I'm not sure what to make of this. Did the people who were responsible for the Martins' disappearance drive all the way to Portland to search their house? And if so, what were they looking for? Did Kevin have potentially incriminating evidence against someone from Hood River County? Once again, if Kenneth traveled there for a meeting because he had dirt on someone, I just don't understand why he would bring his entire family along. As for Donald himself, I'm really not sure what to make of him. If he was the one who orchestrated his family's murders, I suppose he could have enlisted Wayne's help to find someone to carry out the crime while Donald remained in New York. It would be one thing if the family went missing in Portland, but they disappeared after traveling to a location 60 miles away, and I'm not sure how Donald could have known they were going to be there on that particular day, unless he somehow arranged for Wayne to lure them there. But if Donald is innocent, it's possible that because of his strained relationship with his family, he was legitimately indifferent to them going missing, which would explain his lax attitude towards the whole situation and unwillingness to travel to Oregon to assist with the search efforts. I guess Donald's involvement would all depend on motive. Yes, he stood to be the sole beneficiary of the family's estate, but it wasn't a particularly large amount. Even if he was on bad terms with his parents, it's still pretty extreme for him to murder all of his younger sisters. It's alleged that the main reason Donald became estranged from his family and moved to the East Coast was because they found out he was gay, but in spite of this, he still wound up marrying a woman and starting his own family. You'd almost think that with his family no longer hanging over him, Donald would have been less motivated to stay in the closet, but again, this was the 1950s. It's obvious that Detective Graven suspected Donald of being involved, but was unable to build up a case against him and face resistance from other members of law enforcement who did not want to take this any further. I'm not so sure this was an intentional cover-up to protect the killers. I think it just stems from the fact that Lester Kenneth Price and Roy Light had connections to Clifford Slim Bennett, and certain people feared that a thorough investigation might cause a snowball effect, which could open up a major can of worms, exposing corruption for their other criminal activities. So they felt it was in their best interest for this part of the investigation to be shut down, even if it meant that a murdered family would be unable to receive justice. So if you want my theory, I think it does make logical sense that Price and Light were the ones who murdered the Martins and ran their station wagon off the cliff into the Columbia River, and sadly, the bodies of Kenneth, Barbara, and Barbie are still inside the submerged vehicle today. I'm really not sure if Donald or Wayne were involved in what happened, but the discovery of the stolen gun from Meyer and Frank is such a huge red flag that I believe one or both of them has to be connected to this somehow. If that gun had been properly processed as evidence back in 1958, who knows where the investigation might have led. But overall, I can't help but think there's still a big piece of the puzzle missing here, but I'm not sure we'll ever receive full answers until the missing station wagon and the bodies of the remaining victims can be found. After all this time, I'm not sure anyone will ever be prosecuted for this crime, but it would be nice to bring Kenneth, Barbara, and Barbie home and lay them to rest for good. I know that over 60 years have passed, but if by chance you happen to have any information on the unsolved disappearance of the Martin family, please contact the appropriate authorities. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Also, if you want to learn more about this case, I would highly recommend checking out J.B. Fisher's book, Echo of Distant Water, as it contains a lot more details which I didn't even get a chance to delve into. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, we covered another story which was featured on Unsolved Mysteries about the bizarre failed ransom kidnapping of business executive John Grundhofer by an inept, unidentified criminal who somehow managed to avoid getting caught. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. So to learn more information, feel free to visit our Patreon page. I'd also like to take a moment to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Gloria T, Apathetic R3X, Jem N, Andrew L, and the Still Unknown Podcast. Thank you all so much for your support. I also just wanted to give another shout out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online Forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to McGill Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play Music, or Spotify. Anyway, next week's episode is going to be a very special one, as we will have officially reached our podcast's 4th anniversary. Yes, I really cannot believe that we've been around for 4 years already. Per tradition, we put up a poll in which our listeners could vote on which case they would like to see featured on our anniversary episode, and this year, the winner wound up being a very infamous crime, the Oklahoma Girl Scout murders. So have yourselves a great week, and join us next Wednesday for our special 4-year anniversary episode of The Trail Went Cold.